From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the legacy of 9/11. But first, it's time for Capital Chat, our new Friday feature about what's going on in California government. Today's a particularly busy day at the Capitol because it's a deadline for acting on bills. Joining us with details on what's passing and what's not, and also explaining what is involved in this whole gutting and amending process that we've been hearing about, is Capital Public Radio's Marianne Russ. She's at our Capitol Bureau. Marianne, welcome back to Capital Chat.
Thank you for having me.
Well, is it really busy today? I mean, it seems like it should be.
Oh, absolutely. They always save the toughest issues until the end. Often it's the threat of that deadline that results in deals. You see lobbyists lining the hallways, staffers are ordering pizza and lots of other things in. I'm sure that's what they did last night. You know, yesterday they started around 10 in the morning. They didn't wrap up until after 11 o'clock last night. There's almost a frantic deal making that sort of occurs. And you alluded to the gut and amend process. And a lot of this frantic deal making results in new bills being introduced at the last minute. Now, the only way they can do that is through a gut and amend. So they take a current bill about, say, something like recycling, and then they gut it, insert new language about, say, maybe taxes. And then that bill has already been through the process, at least partially. So there are limited steps to get to the floor. Now, they do have to end up holding last-minute committee hearings and so forth. So they'll break for an hour, and then they'll have a couple committee hearings, then they'll come back. And they're doing that today. In fact, there are a couple committee hearings going on right now.
And the gut and amend process is controversial, not just because of the frantic nature of it, but because some people say it's inappropriate because it allows legislation to be introduced at the last moment with very little oversight or discussion.
That's true. These hearings are called very quickly. There's almost no way that the public at large can find out about them in time to get there. This is one reason why you have so many lobbyists there at this final time, just waiting to find out if they need to run into some sort of committee hearing to perhaps testify about a bill that was just introduced that day.
My guest is Marianne Russ. It's our weekly feature, Capital Chat. Yesterday, Governor Brown talked about a deal that he has been working on with Republicans and Democrats that involves taxes and jobs. What's it about?
Yeah, this is a piece of legislation. It passed the Assembly last night. It has yet to pass the state Senate, so its fate is really pretty uncertain. It was crafted by the governor, Democrats, and at least two Assembly Republicans who did vote for it. It sets up what's known as a mandatory single sales factor, and what that means in layman's terms is all companies that do business in California would have to base their corporate taxes on in-state sales. Right now, they have a choice between that and a combination of other factors, and the governor and Democrats say that choice is really benefiting companies who don't have a lot of employees in California. So the upshot of the change would be that out-of-state businesses, or many of them, would end up paying more than they do now. The governor says that'll generate about $1 billion a year, and then he'd use that money to go to tax breaks. And that includes a sales tax reduction on manufacturing equipment purchase, some other business tax cuts, and a bigger personal income tax deduction. So yesterday, the governor called a press conference to sort of send the message to Senate Republicans, whose support he still doesn't have. And he said he was also sending a message to the business community.
More than anything else, I think the fact that we've got some Republicans working with Democrats is a very powerful signal of stability and cooperation, which in and of itself builds a favorable climate for business and investment.
Well, what do the Republicans have to say about this?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, you had two Republicans who voted for the bill and then many who voted against it. One who came out in strong support, even joining Brown at his press conference, was Republican Assemblyman Nathan Fletcher.
We have an obligation as members of this body to do everything we can to help our constituents, to do right by the people that we represent, to step forward and do everything to say we understand how bad it is. And although it may not be perfect, it may not be ideal, it may not be exactly what everyone wants, we are trying to move the ball forward because we hear from you that you're struggling. And we realize that sometimes we have to be willing to step out of our comfort zone just a little bit to do the right thing.
I assume the governor was pleased to have at least a couple of Republicans on his side on a tax measure, but as you said, not all Republicans agreed with those Republicans.
No, you're right. It's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, the governor had been trying all year to get Republicans to vote for his other tax measure as part of the budget and wasn't able to do so. This was actually a big deal for the governor. But of course, on the other side, representing the views of most of the Republicans, at least in the assembly, you had Republican Assemblyman Jim Nielsen.
Taxpayer organizations and the conscience of taxpayers say this is a tax increase. I say that this is a massive tax increase, and that will not serve the citizens that we represent. And I seriously question how many jobs that this will translate into, this tax increase.
Well, this is obviously a very big deal, but there are a lot of other important issues trying to work their way through the Capitol at this time. Maybe we can touch on some of those.
Yeah, absolutely. One is the so-called Amazon tax. This is a bit of a complicated issue, but the bottom line is it's a last-minute deal that lawmakers crafted with Amazon in an effort to avoid a fight at the ballot box. The quick backstory was as part of the budget, lawmakers passed legislation that requires all online retailers to charge California customers sales tax. Now, Amazon didn't like that idea, so it put a lot of money into gathering signatures for a referendum that could possibly overturn the law, and Democratic lawmakers decided they'd try to pass a bill that would make the sales tax law referendum-proof. So, in the end, Amazon got nervous, offered the state a deal. The lawmakers didn't like the first offer, but apparently they liked the second. So it essentially gives Amazon a break for a year and would avoid a referendum. But Governor Brown has yet to sign off on this, and the legislation is still in the works. So it's sort of uncertain what will happen. And lawmakers were counting on $200 million a year from the sales tax law change. So giving Amazon that break does blow another hole in the state budget.
Marianne Rust joins us from our Capitol Bureau. She's Capitol Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief. And this is our new Friday feature, Capitol Chat. We're talking about what's going on at the state capitol today on this busy last day. It's a deadline for acting on bills. Another thing of note this week is a reform of something called CEQA. What is CEQA?
Yeah, that's the California Environmental Quality Act, something that they talk about a lot at the Capitol. Legislation that actually just came into existence this week. It's being heard in a committee as we speak this morning. It's modeled after a bill that speeds up the environmental review process for a stadium in L.A. Democratic Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg wants to take that idea and take it statewide. So the L.A. stadium bill has made it partway through the process. The new bill has yet to pass either chamber. The two bills are linked, and this could have a lot of implications for other projects, sports-related or otherwise.
And also, June ballot measures are in the news this week.
Yeah, this is a bill that's still being put together, would essentially move ballot measures from June to November. Still being worked out, so again, a lot is up in the air, but Democrats say the idea would be to have initiatives voted on during general elections instead of primaries when, of course, turnout is obviously going to be a lot higher. But Republicans say this is just a political move driven by organized labor that's aimed at harming a potential initiative next June that would limit political donations by unions. So, unsurprisingly, it all boils down to politics over here.
Governor Brown is known for his turn of phrase, and he's applied that habit to his veto messages. Some of them are mildly ironic or humorous. Do you have an example?
Yeah, it's actually been great to read some of these. The governor said just this week, he said, I read every bill. I've done 80 bills in the last 2 days. And it appears that he is actually writing his own veto messages, which is a bit unusual. Some of them are sort of philosophical. One example was he surprised some Democrats this week by vetoing a few of their bills. One would have required kids under 18 to wear ski helmets while on the state slopes. And he said, I'm going to quote from it here, I am concerned about the continuing and seemingly inexorable transfer of authority from parents to the state. Not every human problem deserves a law.
Sounds like it could have been said by one of the founding fathers.
You could say that about many of the things that the governor said. I mean, just yesterday he said in response to his tax deal with Republicans, politics is the art of the possible. So he has something like that to say at every press conference.
And finally, Marianne Rust, how realistic is it that lawmakers are going to get all of this work done before midnight tonight?
You know, I'm sort of doubtful that they're going to get all of it done myself, but I do believe that they can probably get quite a bit of it done. A deadline has a way of pushing any of us, and particularly when it comes to politics, pushing people to act. We talked with someone who's always very optimistic last night. That's Democratic Senate Leader Daryl Steinberg. And he said, you know, he really thought they could get the vast majority of it done. And then he joked, you know, we'll be done long before midnight. And then, of course, everyone said, well, you just jinxed that. And he had a great little phrase. He said, if you don't enjoy a day like today, then you belong in a different business. So, you know, this is what it's all about. And he told reporters last night that, you know, he acknowledged the criticism of this sort of last minute process of jamming bills through. But he said, sometimes you have to strike while the iron is hot.
When you have a little momentum and the issues are hot, you sometimes you've got to grab the moment and get it done, because 3 months from now, the environment may change and it may be that much more difficult to get it done.
Well, a busy day for all concerned, including you and your colleagues in the press corps. So best wishes for your work today, Marianne.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
That's Marianne Russ at our Capitol Bureau, talking with us as we do every Friday on Capitol Chat. You're listening to Insight. When we come back, the local scientist who revealed how toxic the air at Ground Zero was, a message that wasn't welcome at the time in Washington. Insight from Capitol Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison, and Insight is online, as Jen Picard will tell us. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Well, we just finished talking about some of the bills that made it through this session of the California legislature, or are going to make it through today. And we'd like to hear from you on them. What do you wish the legislature had gotten accomplished during this session? And are there any bills that you're particularly happy or perhaps upset about? Also, on Monday, we'll be talking with a local reporter about the recently released financing plan for a new arena in downtown Sacramento. Do you have any questions about that plan? What would you like to know about it from a local economist? You can send your questions and comments to insight@capradio.org or go to our Facebook page, Insight at Capitol Public Radio.
Thank you, Jen.
You're very welcome.
Well, 10 years ago on Sunday, the World Trade Center was attacked, like you, I'm sure. I watched the collapse of the buildings in horror and marveled at the bravery of the people who went on the scene almost immediately. But we all also wondered about the air those people were breathing. A UC Davis scientist who's an expert on air quality had the same concern and decided to study the smoke at Ground Zero without official backing. But Thomas Cahill soon found that the government at the time wasn't very interested in hearing what he had to say. I talked recently with Cahill about all this and started by asking exactly how bad the air was at Ground Zero.
The air during the original collapse of the building had lots of dust in it, but it turns out it wasn't very toxic. The stuff that happened from that point on for the next 3 months was very bad. All the computers, all the fluorescent lights and so on were cooking off and making a fine mist, and the people on the pile were breathing it.
When you say cooking off, what do you mean?
The pile was hot and stayed hot all the way into December. The fires were not out until after December. So the thing was, these people were trying to take the building apart, standing on top of what's a fuming chemical factory that was still burning beneath their feet.
A fuming chemical factory? That just sounds like an awful place to be.
It was awful. And in fact, we're seeing the results already in terms of the health effects.
You said that the dust, I guess, that was created when the towers collapsed was not toxic. But I would have thought this finely pulverized concrete and whatever else the building was made of, that would not be too good to breathe either.
Oh, no, it's not too good to breathe. But the point was, it was actually rather traditional distribution of particle sizes. Most of it was quite coarse. Relatively small amount went deep into your lung, and much went into the deep lung was, in fact, gypsum, drywall, and it was relatively harmless. So, yeah, there was a lot of it, and people vomited their guts out when they had it. But in terms of staying in the body and causing long-term health effects, very little remained of that.
At what point did the air become toxic, seriously toxic? Was this like a light switch, or was it a gradual period that it became more and more toxic?
I became worried after a rainstorm happened on the 13th and 14th of September, and I saw the pictures of the pile, and the smoke was blue. Now, blue smoke means very fine particles. Very fine particles go deep into the lung. That's when I became worried. And it turns out the pile was actually getting hotter in that period, and it became more hot and more toxic up till about the end of September. Then it started to cool down somewhat. But my measurements only started in October, too, so I missed the worst of it.
You've referred to these fires. I don't remember seeing fires at the site. These fires presumably were burning deep below ground.
Yes, in fact, the problem was you had an enormous amount of fuel, including diesel oil and furniture and paper and so on, that had been crushed to the basement. And in that fuel, there was almost no oxygen. And the result was that there was a hot pile of rubble that wanted to burn but couldn't until it was exposed to air. So as they pulled the material out, the bottoms of the beams would be red hot, for instance, and paper would suddenly flash into fire all the way till the middle of December. If you picked up a piece of concrete, the paper beneath it would burst into fire.
So the process of removing the rubble and everything else was actually helping the fire continue burning for months.
Very much so.
My guest is Thomas Cahill, Professor Emeritus of Physics and Atmospheric Sciences at UC Davis. He tested the air at Ground Zero after the 9/11 attack. You talked about this blue cloud that you saw a few days after the buildings collapsed. You saw that on TV, I suppose.
Yes, we did. Yeah.
When did you get out there?
I never got out there, actually, turned out. I was worried about it, but I was stuck here in Davis, which is a long way from there. But until one of my friends who worked in New York City, Professor Robert Leifer, happened to have a laboratory at the southernest part of the city that still had electric power. And he called me up and said, Tom, could you send me one of your air samplers from Davis? Got down to FedEx and shipped it out to him, and then he set it up on October 2nd.
This was a friend and colleague of yours in New York who asked for your assistance with this. Was he working in any official capacity testing the air there, or was he freelancing in a way?
He was freelancing. We had worked together in Mount St. Helens and other projects already, so we had become good friends, and we knew each other's capabilities. And he was just close as you can get to the actual site and still electric power. And so he decided on his own initiative to go ahead and put a sampling up on the roof of his building. And that's what we did.
So he wasn't actually, he wasn't able to put this measuring device actually at the Ground Zero site, but nearby.
Right, about a mile away. There was no power near Ground Zero. And the people who ran had to have special batteries. The USEPA had a few sites down there supported by generators and so on, but we couldn't get there.
So he was a mile away. What do you think the air would have been like actually at Ground Zero? Would it have been worse?
Oh, yes. Every so often, typically at night, the plume from the thing would cross a sampling site, and we get this real shot of stuff very high. And when the air had a subsidence inversion and was pushed close to the ground, we get very high levels of materials. On those days, what we measured a mile away was about what they were measuring actually at the site. And so we know that in those cases that we were actually getting a pretty good representation of what people were breathing.
What did your friend do to protect himself? I mean, if this machine was measuring toxic air a mile away from Ground Zero, did he take precautions himself?
No.
And
almost nobody else did, by the way, because they were told by Christy Whitman the air was safe to breathe. We got to believe the EPA administrator, right?
And you knew that that was not accurate information.
Oh, yes. And I tried to tell the EPA that. In fact, I called them up when I found the information. We got the samples back in November, analyzed them at the Advanced Light Source in Berkeley in December, and by around Christmas, I knew we had a real problem. So I called up the administrator of the US EPA Region 2 and said, I've got some information that may be important to protect the health of the workers. And they asked me two questions. Who asked you to do it, and who paid for it?
And what was your answer?
The answer is, we did it because we're good citizens, and nobody paid for it. It was all volunteer effort. So then we called up the University of California, went up and called the EPA in Washington, D.C., which is about to have hearings under, of all people, Hillary Clinton.
And she was a U.S. senator from New York.
Bingo. Anyway, so we offered our state, and they said, your information is not needed. We have our experts already.
And what did those experts say about the air?
One of the experts said that the air that they were breathing was polluted by stuff that was coming off power plants in Ohio.
Is that possible?
There was a small amount of regional aerosol from power plants, but it was a tiny fraction of what they're breathing.
Well, how do you explain the discrepancy between what you found in the air at Ground Zero and what these other experts hired by the federal government found?
It's a question I almost prefer not to answer in any kind of detail. Let's say our technology at Davis was better than theirs, and perhaps our motivation was a little clearer.
Seriously, your equipment was better?
Oh, yes. I mean, the stuff we have at UC Davis is the best in the world.
Would the discrepancy between the quality of your equipment and this equipment that was used for the feds, would that explain the difference in results? Would that be enough?
The feds had, in fact, good information by then that the air was dangerous. And that information was only slowly leaking out of Washington. And I had to go to their website every day and pull information down from it and then print a hard copy, because next day it might be gone. Games are being played with the data.
The toxic air at Ground Zero, what kind of health effects, before you knew what did happen, what kind of health effects would you have expected to find in people who were exposed to it?
We were expecting to find the kind of things you'd get from breathing very fine particles like diesel exhaust. I would have expected to see carcinogens and so on in the air. The particles would be very fine. What they're made of, I did not know. But the point was, the whole thing was so unusual and so worrisome that we had to find out.
And what kind of health effects have we seen in the people who spend a lot of time there?
Well, we can list the ways. We start off by the World Trade Center cough. The people had this rough type cough they had, and that was caused by the combination of fine powdered dust with about the same pH as Drano on the back of the membranes of your nose and throat, down your throat with cilia that had been actually numbed by the presence of sulfuric acid. So that's a start.
That sounds horrific.
Yeah, it is horrific. In fact, the term I used in my press release was brutal. It was not appreciated, by the way.
Well, yeah, I'm not surprised. What would you have done if you had been there? I mean, let's just say that you were one of the people, that you were a firefighter or a retired firefighter in New York, and you felt compelled to go down and help out there. But knowing what you know about the air, what would you have done?
During the first few days, I'd have done exactly what they did. I'd have run into the site with no protection and tried to find anybody who was alive. And after 7 days, I'd have put a barbed wire fence around the entire facility, taken everybody out of it, and put the fires out. And once the fires were out, which would have taken months, then go and try to do other work in the place.
But politically, that's very difficult to do because thousands of people knew that the remains of their loved ones were in there.
It may have been difficult, but the law was very clear, namely that was, in fact, should have been a site protected by the federal government, and they simply did not follow their own regulations.
Now, you said that the feds didn't seem very interested in talking with you when you had your findings about the quality of the air at Ground Zero, but it should be noted that you have a long history of doing scientific work that at the federal level. You worked with the US EPA back in the 70s on air quality at national parks and also in car pollution and so on. So you are someone who is well-known in US EPA and federal circles as an air quality expert.
I actually ran the National Park Service EPA network for all the parks and monuments for 20 years. Oh, I'm well-known, all right. But also, at the University of California, we're also rather independent. And I think there was a worrisome factor there. I think the thing that really got to us when we found out later that the statements made by Christy Whitman, including this famous statement, "The air is safe to breathe," had a clause after it. And her clause was, "But the measurements we have made raise concerns about people working on the pile and coming to work closer than," I think it was, "Water Street." And that phrase was removed by the White House. And it turns out then the EPA Inspector General, a brave woman named Nikki Tinsley, took the memos as written by Christy Whitman, took the memos as released by the White House, and compared them side by side, and showed again and again there was whiteout interference with the information from the EPA.
Well, the clause that you just cited from the original version of Christy Whitman's statement basically negated the first part of the sentence, didn't it?
What she really meant to say was this: the air is safe to breathe in most of New York.
Ah.
And then the next statement would follow directly. But it became misinterpreted, and the people on the site, I talked to people there who just, they could, no, the air is not good. Cough, cough. They knew it. Everybody knew it. But in fact, they'd been told it was safe to breathe, and the city of New York people reiterated that same statement repeatedly.
All this happened years ago. I mean, not just the 9/11 attacks, but your work there. What happened after the incidents that you've talked about, which unfolded over, I guess, a couple of years? In recent years, have you tried to raise the issue again with the feds? Have people from New York come to you and asked for more information or your reactions?
Well, let me clarify the word feds, because when I contacted my friends at the US EPA Research Division, their first question was, what did you find? And a lot of people who work for the US EPA were leaking information to us all the period because they wanted to get the information out in detail, and yet it was being suppressed. They were embarrassed at what the EPA was doing. So there are a lot of people who work for the federal government, EPA, who are, in my mind, heroes. Anyway, in 2003, the American Chemical Society decided to have a meeting in New York City on September 10th, and they had a meeting on exactly the World Trade Center. And out of the woodwork came all these scientists who had, on their own volition, somehow stolen money or equipment, gone up to New York and made measurements. And these people finally had a neutral forum to present their data. And that case, a lot of stuff came out that had not been known until then, and it became clear from all the papers that were done that it was local, it was caused by the World Trade Center, and there were inevitable health effects coming down the line. The most obvious one, what you've already seen, loss of lung function. The metals tend to get into the lung and cause a reaction which sort of traumatizes the tissue and you lose the ability to breathe. And there's 12,000 people right now out of 18,000 who have lost lung function because they worked in that pile.
Now, this conversation has been with you as a scientist and expert on air quality, but what about you as an individual looking back at this whole thing? What do you make of it?
I'm furious. And in fact, I joined as a plaintiff's expert with the New York Fire Department people. And if the case had gone to trial last year, I'd have happily testified. Fortunately, in January, a settlement was arranged for $750 million to pay the health damage for these people indefinitely. And that's, in a way, a nice vindication of 10 years of hard work by a lot of people, not just me.
Thomas Cahill, Professor Emeritus of Physics and Atmospheric Sciences at UC Davis, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, more on the legacy of 9/11. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Joining us with details is Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio's senior editor. He's in our newsroom, and I guess we're going to focus on the arena financing deal.
Well, I want you to think Cuba Gooding Jr. as Rod Tidwell in the movie Jerry Maguire, the classic line, "Show me the money."
Yes.
The task force that calls itself Think Big, in capital letters, Sacramento, has come up with a plan, a rough outline, to be kind, to raise about $400 million to put a new arena in the rail yards. The one significant missing element is direct taxpayer participation. Voters will not get a chance to say no, at least not this way. The plan would include user fees, new hotel taxes, the sale of city-owned land, including the Power Balance Pavilion land or the land it squats on. And unlike the arrangement at Power Balance, the Kings would not be owners, they would be tenants.
I guess we need to hear from the Maloof family, who are the owners of the Kings.
Yeah, we got the most general of responses complimenting the fact that somebody had actually done something from the Maloofs yesterday, but it looked to me like a response that could have been written weeks ago. Anyway, where we go next is anybody's guess. The next plan goes to the city council. That'll happen next week, and that, Jeffrey, could be important because the city could be asked to guarantee the bonds that would be needed to finance construction, and that might raise some questions.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, that's it.
Alan Ray, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Alan Ray in our newsroom. Most of us remember where we were and what we did when the 9/11 attacks happened, but what was that terrible day like for U.S. government workers and embassies in the Middle East? Joining us is Gordon Olson. He's a retired Foreign Service official. He worked for the State Department for 25 years. Around the time of 9/11, he was Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi. Gordon Olson, welcome back to our program, because you actually joined us in an unrelated matter a couple of weeks ago, but today we're going to talk about 9/11.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Great to be back.
What was it like for U.S. embassy workers overseas when 9/11 struck and it became apparent that there'd been a terrorist attack on the country?
Well, particularly, I was the chargé, the acting ambassador in Abu Dhabi, our embassy in the United Arab Emirates on that fateful day. And I remember, like it was yesterday, my secretary ran in and said, "You have to turn on CNN. A plane just flew into the Empire State Building." Those were her exact words. Of course, it wasn't. She wasn't a New Yorker. And that moment, our embassy, our focus changed dramatically. Pre-9/11, our embassy in the Emirates basically did trade promotion. It's a very wealthy country. Did a lot of work getting business, American businesses into the Emirates, getting Emiratis to come to the States to do business, getting Emiratis to go to school here. After that, the entire focus of the embassy became support for Operation Enduring Freedom when that began against Afghanistan, and counterterrorism, because the attacks there were, I mean, the attack on 9/11 was the beginning of al-Qaeda's effort to try to force the U.S. out of the region.
And what was the position of the United Arab Emirates, the government you were working with, what was their position in all of this, and specifically on al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
Very interesting, because at that moment in history, there were only three countries who recognized the Taliban authorities in Afghanistan: Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and the United Arab Emirates, because Emiratis did a lot of hunting, falcon hunting in Afghanistan. So there was a close ties between the authorities in Afghanistan and the Emirates. And I remember spending many hours with the senior Emirati leadership in the days immediately following 9/11, constantly reminding them. I would tell, you know, crown princes, emirs, ministers, that most Americans had either never heard of the UAE or had just the vaguest notion of what it was. But now, every 15 minutes on CNN, there was a list: Taliban, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, UAE, constantly, every 10 minutes on CNN, and that was a very bad list to be on for the Emirates. So I spent a lot of time trying to convince them to immediately break relations with the Taliban, which they did, not immediately, but, you know, within a week or two. And that was important to the U.S. and really important to the UAE, because it was just a terrible list to be on, viewed from the American perspective.
I'm talking with Gordon Olson. He lives in Sacramento now. He's a retired career Foreign Service officer, and he was the Deputy Chief of Mission and Charge at the U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, around the time of the 9/11 attacks. What kind of guidance did you get from Washington at that time?
Well, surprisingly, I mean, typically in embassies, we're carrying out quite specific instructions that were given by the State Department. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I'm talking, you know, the day or two or three or four days after the attack, there was an enormous power vacuum in Washington. No one was quite sure what was going on, if this was the beginning of more serious attacks, additional attacks. So we actually got an instruction cable, which was, I mean, sent around to all the relevant embassies, that basically said, in the immediate aftermath of this attack, while we're deciding which way to go, take actions you deem appropriate.
And that seems rather vague.
And that's, well, it basically meant use your best judgment because you're on the ground and do what you can to advance our national interests as you understand them.
Now, one complication for the U.S. and the United Arab Emirates was that at least one of the hijackers was from the UAE, was he not?
Actually, three of the hijackers, including one of the pilots, were Emiratis. And if I can just tell you a short story, several days after the attacks, we already had lists of the likely hijackers, and three of them were Emirati citizens. I'm not residents of the Emirates. They were all out of the Hamburg cell, but they were Emiratis. And one of the pilots was an Emirati, or we believed to be. So we actually got a picture of the pilot, and I contacted my Emirati colleagues and asked them if they could confirm the name and date of birth, et cetera. They could. A washout cadet. I said, do you have a picture? And we actually met, and each, almost like a liar's poker game, each showed the photograph to make sure we're talking about the same person, and in fact, we were.
Was that an awkward moment for the UAE?
I think, in one sense, yes, but we recognize that the UAE hadn't attacked us. The UAE has been and continues to be a trusted ally, but three Emiratis were among the 19. So it was awkward, and I think we all hoped that maybe it wasn't the same person, but it was, and we recognized that the Emirates would be in the fight with us, even though these Emiratis had caused it.
And given that three of the hijackers were from the UAE, were you and your colleagues in Abu Dhabi concerned about your safety at that time?
You know, I've served in the Middle East a lot, so I would say no more than usual, but the Emiratis made an incredibly accelerated effort to make sure we were secure, because they wanted to make sure that the message was clear to Washington that Abu Dhabi and the Emirates were in the fight with us and would protect us as we move forward.
Gordon Olson, a retired State Department official. He lives in Sacramento. Also with us is Scott Cutler-Shershow, who's a professor of English at UC Davis. He's written a lot over the years about the legal, political, and philosophical issues raised by America's war on terrorism. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
What do you think about the way that the United States reacted, at least in the short and medium term, to the attacks of 9/11?
Well, I would raise a variety of objections and questions about that. It's an extraordinarily complicated subject that can't be really evaluated in a few words. But in brief, it seems to me that I would almost say that we reacted to this obviously enormous and striking crime by, in effect, deciding to ignore really at least a century of very careful work codified in the Geneva Conventions as well as other documents, which had decided that there were certain limits to what sovereign states could do with regard to individual human rights. It was as though we said, well, all those rules are fine for a normal day, but now we've been attacked. This is serious. And the rules are obviously made precisely for those moments of crisis. That's when they should be observed above all, it seems to me.
And you're referring to, for example, the extraordinary rendition, the flying around of suspects by the CIA and other parts of the U.S. government and other governments, in fact, allegedly to be tortured and Guantanamo prison and those sorts of things.
Yes, it's a whole constellation. We might call it the dark side after Cheney's famous remark. But it's Guantanamo, it's renditions. I would also add, and this is a perhaps something that many people would be shocked to hear me say, but it seems to me that, for example, the war in Iraq is, according to any conceivable understanding of international law, illegal. It was essentially an unprovoked aggression by one sovereign state against another, which was actually the offense that we tried most of the Germans after World War II at Nuremberg for.
Gordon Olson, as someone who's serving the State Department at the time, which wasn't always fully aligned with, I think it's fair to say, the vice president at the time and the Defense Department, how did these tensions, if they were even perceived as tensions, play out for people like you in your daily work? In other words, the tensions between the crisis that was facing the United States around the time of 9/11 and the way the U.S. responded and how sometimes that, to some people at least, conflicted with longstanding American values.
Good question, Jeffrey. I think for the career diplomats like myself, our job was to project American policy and to represent that to our foreign interlocutors. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, things like Operation Enduring Freedom, actions in Afghanistan, I think are distinct from later actions in Iraq. But our efforts, I mean, President Bush, in a speech to the joint session of Congress, talked immediately after the attacks, said night fell, among many other things, said that night fell on a different world. And I think that was very true for actions America took in the aftermath of 9/11 and beyond, were looking at the world as fundamentally changed. And I take the point that, you know, international lawyers argue about whether or not the invasion of Iraq was legal. But for the diplomats, we projected that those are extraordinary times and are going to be extraordinary measures taken. And, you know, we kind of let the chips fall where they may among the lawyers.
Scott Cutler, Shershow, you're a professor at a university in California. How do you imagine that you would have balanced all this if you had actually been in a position of great authority in Washington at that time? Because it's one thing to look at things from a distance and say these actions are conflicting with American values. It's another thing to be the person who actually has to make the decisions that he or she deems necessary to keep the country safe.
Yes. Well, I would like to think that I could make decisions that were better than those made at the time. I do believe, for example, that there's nothing utopian or unrealistic to suggest that President Bush could have decided. Actually, all American actions, interestingly, were with regard to detainees and the like, were justified officially in terms of prevailing international law. And therefore, it seems to me we could have, Bush could have, and we as a people could have decided that these people who were coming into our hands, into our custody, we could have just unilaterally decided that they are to be treated, to use the language of Geneva, with all of the guarantees that are normally considered indispensable by civilized people. That's the language of Geneva, and it seems to me we could have done that. Why not? We could have said that this was a crime if they were to be treated in law courts. I understand that those on the right mock that, but I don't understand. I believe in our institutions and in our courts, and I believe they could have handled this.
Finally, Gordon Olson, maybe you can't answer this question, but was it apparent to you and others in the State Department at the embassy level that there were tensions between the Secretary of State at the time, Colin Powell, and the Vice President and the President and the Secretary of Defense?
I would say yes, but really only as informed citizens, because we're sort of duty-bound to project U.S. policies as they're finally worked out. And, you know, throughout our history, there have been many policies that were painfully arrived at. Our job out in the field was, once they're arrived at, was convince our foreign friends or our foreign adversaries that this was the way to move forward.
That's Gordon Olson, retired U.S. State Department official. Around the time of the 9/11 attacks, he was Deputy Chief of Mission and Chargé at the U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. He lives now in Sacramento. And Scott Cutler-Shershow, professor of English at UC Davis. He's written about America's war on terrorism, various issues raised by that. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, Cave Women, an all-woman jazz band with world music influences. Listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. San Diego was almost entirely dark last night because of a surprising and widespread power outage. Most people's electricity came on early this morning. San Diegans can expect a sunny day today with a very San Diego temperature of 75 degrees. And turning to the foothills town of Twain Hart, why doesn't it have a film festival? Well, someone must have asked that question and did something about it, because the inaugural Twain Hart Independent Film Festival starts tonight and runs through the weekend. But I guess they weren't banking on today's weather. It'll reach 94 degrees today in Twain Hart, similarly high temperatures and perhaps thunderstorms tomorrow. And that's pretty much the picture throughout our area. Today, 100 degrees in Sacramento, 102 in Yuba City, Marysville, and 94 in Quincy and 90 in Reno. That's our hot forecast for today in this region. Five Sacramento jazz musicians, all young women with eclectic tastes, have banded together to write and play their own brand of music. They go by the name Cave Women and are inspired by jazz, classical, and world music. Tonight they play the Fox and Goose in downtown Sacramento. Right now they're in our studio. Cave Women, welcome to Insight.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Well, let's start with Casey Lipka. We'll talk briefly with all of you, but Casey, what do you do in the band?
I play bass and imbira, which is a thumb piano from Zimbabwe, and I sing.
Well, I'm glad you explained what the imbira is. Is that that distinctive sound you often hear in African music?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the thumb piano, I guess you said. And Allison Yaffe is also with us. Am I saying your name right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's, well, good enough anyway. What do you do in the band?
I play guitar and sing.
Are you going to be able to explain to us the name of the band, Cave Women?
Well, actually, it's an acronym, and
what is?
Yeah, Cave Woman. Yeah. So Casey, and then my name Allison, and Vanessa, our drummer, and then Emily.
And then one person is left out of that. Mm-hmm. That would be Kim. I don't see the your name represented in the acronym, Kim. Yeah. Davis. Why
well,
is that?
We were trying to get it in there, but it was kind of awkward, just like trying to read like K-C-A-V-E, and I don't know. It just kind of worked better, I thought.
Well, maybe you could tell your mom it's spelled K-A-V-E-K.
There you go.
So you really are in the band.
Yeah.
So that's Kim. Kim, what do you do in the band?
So I sing and I play flute and just kind of whatever else needs to be done.
Whatever needs to be done.
Well,
goodness.
Just, you know.
Clarinet.
Like, yeah. Oh, yeah, clarinet. Yeah.
Yes. So. Well, two more people to quickly introduce you to. Emily Messick.
Yeah.
Emily, what do you do in the band?
I usually play accordion in some of the songs and I'll sing and sometimes just acoustic guitar, so...
Accordion.
Yeah.
That's not a very commonly used instrument in jazz.
Yeah, it's not. We kind of just, well, we're really influenced by this artist, Becca Stevens, who uses accordion in her band. And so I guess we were figuring out some of her tunes. And so I just picked up the accordion to cover the song. And then we just started adding it to our music. So.
And Vanessa Cruz, what do you do?
I play drums in the band.
Play drums, yeah.
Yeah.
And percussion?
Some percussion on some songs.
Yes. My guests are all members of the group Cave Women, and they're fundamentally a jazz band, but with heavy world influences. You're going to hear them play in our studio in a moment. But first, let's listen to a clip of one of their songs. This was written by Casey Lipkin. It's called Under the Willow Tree.
In time, I hope to be strong like you, yet free as the sea. Pushing, pulling, releasing. You've grown so steadily.
The song is Under the Willow Tree. Casey, that's a beautiful song, and that instrument we're hearing in the background, is that the imbira?
Mm-hmm, that is the imbira.
Yeah. Tell us about the song, how you came to write it.
Let's see, it was over the summer, and I was just sitting there one day with the imbira, and this melody came to my mind, and it just was a lot of textures and pieces, and slowly we added on other voices and background, and now we actually do that song, and Vanessa does percussive stuff, so it's grown a lot.
But it actually started with the imbira.
Mm-hmm. Just imbira and voice.
Right. Well, let's hear a song played in our studio by Cave Women. And Emily, the song was written by you.
Yes,
what song
it
is it?
Who Needs Dreams.
Okay. Anything you should tell us about it first?
I don't know. I guess we'll just see what people think.
Okay. Well, let's hear it then.
Thank you.
Well, that's a beautiful song and a very nice performance. Who Needs Dreams, written by Emily Messick. She's one of the members of Cave Women who played that in our studio. Let's see. Kim Davis, it seems that when I look at all what you all do, Sacramento State seems to be a common denominator, at least among most of you, and you're all playing jazz in various ways. Is that where you met at Sac State?
Yeah, we all met somehow through Sacramento, and some of us have now graduated, but I think there's Emily, me, and Allison who still go to Sac State. Yeah. So then we just met Vanessa, I think, through a couple
jam
people.
Session.
Jam session, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
And Vanessa, how long has the group been together?
I did a New Year's Eve gig with Casey and Allison this past New Year's Eve, and then we started doing gigs where Emily would come and sing harmonies, and I thought that was really nice, you know.
So it's just sort of gradually augmented
built.
Over the last few months.
Yeah, and then we did a recording session, and Kim was there, and I really liked the group's harmonies and yes. the unique, you know, instruments, so...
Well, that's Cave Women. They play the Fox and Goose in downtown Sacramento tonight at 8. They also have 5 other concerts in Sacramento coming up in the next 2 weeks. You'll find a link to more information about Cave Women at our page, capradio.org/insight. Cave Women, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's Insight for today and for this week. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Lynn Weaver. Assistant producer, James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Most of us remember where we were and what we did when the 9/11 attacks happened. What was that terrible day like for U.S. government workers and embassies in the Middle East? I'm Jeffrey Callison, and today on Insight, we'll talk with a retired State Department official who now lives in Sacramento. Also, UC Davis scientist Thomas Cahill, who made few friends in Washington when he revealed how toxic the air at Ground Zero was. Turned out the government didn't want to hear that at the time, but Cahill and a colleague persevered. You'll hear his remarkable story. Also today on Capital Chat, a busy day for California lawmakers, the deadline for acting on bills. We'll find out what's passing and what's not, and hear more about the tax and jobs package Governor Brown is promoting. First, the news.